Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
The Jewish Community Center in Albany was evacuated this week and searched after it and several other centers around the country received anonymous emails with vague threats that mentioned a bomb. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports.
According to New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's office, Cuomo went to the Sidney Albert JCC Sunday after police evacuated about 100 people, searched the building with dogs, and declared it safe. Albany Police spokesman Steve Smith.
Around 5 after 11 yesterday, we were notified via phone by an employee at the Albany JCC that they had received an email that was very vague, but it had some threatening language in it, including the word bomb. So there was certainly concern there, and they notified the police. We, in turn, had our officers respond to the buildings located on Whitehall Road. There are two buildings. There's the community center itself, and then attached, which is directly next door, is the daycare center. So our officers responded. Our canine officer, who has a dog that is certified in detecting incendiary devices and bombs, also responded. And he, because of the size of the building, requested the assistance of our law enforcement partners at the Troy Police Department and the Albany County Sheriffs, who also have dogs that serve in that capacity. The officers and their canine partners were able to sweep that building and determine that there was no device inside either building or any threat to the public.
State police also assisted. The JCC was closed the rest of Sunday. Cuomo's office says similar threats were emailed to people with Jewish Community Center accounts at 18 other JCCs around the country. Smith had no further details concerning the threats, which are reportedly under FBI scrutiny.
We've increased patrols at the Jewish Community Center throughout the day, evening, and overnight.
At the JCC Sunday, Cuomo condemned the incident and anti-Semitism. He discussed the latest Monday at the Capitol.
We have no additional information. It was a threat that came in through email. These are very hard to track. We've had situations before where it comes from overseas, but it's routed through a New York server, so it looks like it came through. So it is still ongoing. But it was it's just another ugly incident in a series of ugly incidents. I went there yesterday just to make sure everything was being done and under control, but also just to say, you know, I'm sorry. This is not who we are. And I speak for all the good people of New York when I say we're sorry, and we're sorry you had to feel this. Jewish community is such an important part of New York. It's still shocking to me that we could have these situations in New York.
Smith says the JCC reopened on schedule Monday morning.
We also, this morning, as parents were dropping their kids off to the daycare center, had patrol stationed right at the JCC to just provide comfort and allow people in the community to know that we are there so that they feel safe. And we'll be doing the same this afternoon as children are being picked up.
The JCC itself was unavailable for comment in time for this story. Smith urges residents to be vigilant and call police if you observe suspicious activity. In 2018, an American-Israeli teen in Israel was found guilty of sending 2,000 bomb threats to Jewish community centers, including the Albany JCC, as well as to schools, airports, shopping malls, hospitals, police stations, the Israeli embassy in the United States, and more.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
A new poll out this week shows support for New York's bail reform plummeting, following weeks of pushback about the new laws from police groups and prosecutors. More from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
The Siena College poll finds that just one-third of New Yorkers now think that the January 1 laws were a good idea. They ended most forms of cash bail for nonviolent crimes and shortened the time prosecutors have to hand over evidence to defendants. When bail reform was first approved last April, 55% of voters liked the law. Siena spokesman Steve Greenberg says the shift can in part be attributed to the public debate now playing out in the media, where law enforcement groups offer examples of repeat offenders that they say are going free because of the new laws.
It's covered on NPR, but also on the 6 o'clock news and the 11 o'clock news and the 8 o'clock morning news and in their newspaper, so voters know what's going on.
Pro-bail reform groups have begun running television ads on Long Island, where the public has been divided on the issue. Greenberg says in those suburban areas, support for the bail reform laws has risen slightly, though the majority still oppose it. Governor Andrew Cuomo is one of several Democratic lawmakers who backed the law, but now says it may need some revisions. Cuomo says he hopes some changes can be included in the state budget due at the end of March. He says by then there'll be some data collected on how well the law is working.
The law went into effect in January. We do a budget April 1. I think that is an appropriate amount of time to have an intelligent conversation, let emotions subside, let people calm down a little bit, actually have some facts that you can discuss.
Cuomo says he wants to separate the facts from what he calls crazy partisanship. Some Democrats in the Senate say they also want to make some changes, including potentially giving judges more leeway to assign bail to some defendants. Bail reform supporters are angered by those proposals. They plan protests at the Capitol this week. So far, Democrats in the Assembly say they don't want to change the law. Another recently enacted law that's been causing controversy is the green light legislation. That began in mid-December, and it allows undocumented immigrants to apply for standard driver's licenses. The administration of President Donald Trump has said because that law shields DMV data from federal agencies, New Yorkers will no longer be eligible for trusted traveler programs like Nexus and Global Entry. The green light law has never been popular overall with voters, though Greenberg says it's always been divided along political party lines.
Dead even. 48% support, 48% oppose. And not surprisingly, Democrats strongly support the law, Republicans strongly oppose the law, independents are against the law, but they are not as negative as they've been in the past, which is why the support for the bill improved, albeit gradually.
Cuomo says he's continuing to try to talk to federal agencies to break the standoff over the DMV data, but so far, he says, he hasn't had any success. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. You had an interesting conversation this week with the majority leader of the New York State Assembly. Her name, Crystal Peoples-Stokes. She's from the 141st District. That's the Buffalo area. You talked to her about a number of things, including this contentious issue of bail reform. She says she thinks the speaker is right. Of course, that's Carl Hastie. He says that the bail law must be examined on the facts, not fear. Nonetheless, the public in recent polls is very concerned about the change.
Well, that's right. It's an easy fix, but Hastie doesn't want to fix it. Look, Hastie is a powerful man. He is a guy who represents his constituency extremely well. People are concerned about the unfairness of bail, and it is unfair, no two ways about it. But it's got to be done in such a way that people's apprehensions will be quieted. And we know, based on polling and other things, that people are quite upset about it. And we know that the Republicans are trying to take back the Senate on the back of it. And in some of those Long Island districts and other places where they've just gained the majority in the Senate, it could be a death knell. So we know that within the Democratic Party, there's a fierce debate going on.
Well, let's go from Peoples-Stokes and Speaker Hastie and their hard line on bail reform to the governor, who late this week said, for the first time, wants to make sure there are some adjustments in the legislation.
Well, his problem is Speaker Hastie. Hasty, of course, is a prominent leader. He is African-American, and he has to represent his district. And his district knows that the way that the bail system has worked in the past has been awful. If you have money, you can afford bail. If you don't, you sit in rotten jail in one of the worst jails in the country, Rikers Island, and you just sit there because you can't come up with the money. That's just wrong. On the other hand, we have basically taken the controls that the judges have away from them, and that's not entirely reasonable. Look, judges are sitting up there, and if they see somebody who could be a real problem, they can impose bail, which just guarantees that somebody will be around. You know, People Stokes said to us this week, his deputy, that what people are saying about bail is wrong, that, you know, basically people don't get out and commit a second crime. I don't know that, and I don't think anybody knows it. But if it's true and if it's possible, then judges should be able to say, you stay put because you are a real danger to society.
And there's always a debate. We've seen it year in, year out, that the city, New York City, should separate itself from upstate New York, the sort of upstate-downstate divide. People Stokes, who you'll be speaking with for your Capital Connection program tomorrow at 3, didn't go for the bait. She says, hey, you know, there's a reason why New York City gets the money it does. It has the population. We're a representative democracy, and Buffalo benefits from the money that comes out of New York.
You know, it's a bunch of baloney. It always has been, the idea of splitting one state into two or even three, which we recently saw. It isn't going to happen. And she's right. New York City is the cash cow, and it has the ability to support much of what happens in New York State. It does have the population. The upstate areas are in some disarray and are hurting. And I think that's one of the reasons why Governor Cuomo has been so assiduous in getting programs around the area. And it is also probably why, frankly, he comes on WAMC as much as he does. He knows this is a population that he needs.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has taken the next step towards setting drinking water limits for two PFAS chemicals, PFOA and PFOS. Environmentalists say the step is small and they want to see quicker, bolder action. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn with more.
The EPA has proposed a so-called regulatory determination to set a national drinking water standard for PFOA and PFOS, emerging contaminants found in Hoosick Falls and Newburgh, respectively. Melanie Benesch is legislative attorney with the Washington, D.C. headquartered Environmental Working Group. She says it could be years, however, before EPA sets final enforceable standards, if at all.
This is definitely regulation moving at a snail's pace, and it's really years overdue.
In addition to proposing to regulate PFOS and PFOA, EPA is asking for information and data on other PFAS substances, as well as seeking comment on potential monitoring requirements and regulatory approaches the agency is considering for PFAS chemicals. Liz Moran is Environmental Policy Director for the New York Public Interest Research Group.
So they've taken a notch forward. We do think that this is a positive step. They're certainly hearing the outcry from the public. People are deeply concerned about the widespread use of these chemicals and how widespread it's now becoming prevalent in people's drinking water. So this is the right step. But that said, states shouldn't wait for the staff. This could be a really long process. And states like New York need to make sure we are setting drinking water standards that are stringent and aligned with the most conservative health science.
In New York, the Drinking Water Quality Council has recommended 10 parts per trillion for PFOA and PFOS each, and one part per billion for 1,4-dioxane, levels the State Department of Health is anticipated to adopt in the coming months. NYPERG and others had been pushing for even lower levels. Environmental Working Group's Benesch agrees states need to take the lead.
PFAS is a chemical that's in the blood of virtually every living being, and it's really hard to overstate the urgency that there is for the government to step in and make real meaningful regulations on these chemicals. And what the agency has done last week is a positive step forward, but more needs to be done and needs to be done quickly.
Another proposal EPA issued the same day would restrict some uses of so-called long-chain PFAS chemicals. Benesch says it's a rehash of a 2015 proposal.
And what that does is codify some of the voluntary phase out of particular kinds of PFAS chemicals that that industry agreed to under pressure from EPA.
As part of its PFAS action plan, the agency is proposing regulations on imported products that contain certain long-chain PFAS chemicals used as surface coatings. EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler says the regulation would close a loophole. While EPA believes the use of these chemicals as surface coatings in imported goods has been phased out, this proposal would ensure that EPA reviews any new uses for surface coatings on products such as furniture, automobile parts, and household appliances before such products could be imported. Again, Banesh.
And so what it means is if you're going to start using these chemicals again, you have to get permission from EPA first. So it's not a complete ban, but it's more regulation than what currently exists.
Meantime, Democratic New York Congressman Antonio Delgado recently wrote to EPA Regional Administrator Pete Lopez, following up on topics Lopez addressed at a Hoosick Falls Community Working Group meeting in January.
We're still hoping that they will take on and set a maximum contaminant level, something they could do again on their own accord, but they have not. So I made a point to stress to Mr. Lopez, we need a timeline. We need to understand what where the urgency is. And he explained that he'd get back to me with that timeline, and so we'll see what it looks like.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
Joining us in studio today is Fred Cole. Many of you know that name if you're associated with UUP, United University Professions. He is the president of that union, and we welcome him to the studio today. Welcome, Fred.
Great to be here. Thanks, Dave.
Obviously, it's budget time in Albany. They face a $6 billion gap. We know each year, if you follow Albany politics, that interest groups come to the Capitol and they want their piece of the pie. You folks are no different, and by disclosure, you're underwriters of WAMC. I happen to be an adjunct at the University at Albany, and I'm in the UUP, so let's get that out of the way. But still, one of the things that I was shocked, actually, to read in preparing for this interview is that many of the campuses are struggling to close deficits, and that has prompted many across the state to get out to make a statement to the governor and the legislature that SUNY needs to be funded.
That's right. And I think it's imperative for New Yorkers, you know, across the state to realize how crucial SUNY is in terms of the health care that's provided at the SUNY hospitals, the education that goes on across the board in the campuses we represent, but also you include the community college, you know, 64 campuses. It's still the largest system in the country. And for year after year, there to be flat budgets, it's untenable. It is not a sustainable model for public finance, for a university system. Costs rise. They have to be dealt with. Now, the increase that the governor put in the executive budget is, you know, there is a small increase. Well, that's covering the fringe benefits that are negotiated when contract negotiations take place. So that's almost a separate category. In terms of the funding for the educational mission of SUNY, that has been flat for 10 years now, and that's 10 years too long.
How are we going to overcome this? And we know with just education, the lower grades, for example, they sued the Campaign for Fiscal Equity. They won a lawsuit. They're supposed to put more money in for education. It has not been done. And they're always tweaking with that formula. Now you go to higher education. You want more money, of course. You say the governor's put a little bit of a raise in. Obviously, you want some more. How do we make that happen? I see one of your solutions here is revenue streams, sort of a coded quote word for raising taxes. And I know you do support this wealth tax.
We do. We believe it is absolutely the most appropriate time for taxes to be raised on those most able to pay, those that have benefited the most from this very tepid recovery that we've had since the Great Recession. When you look at the fact that the number of millionaires and billionaires continues to rise, skyrocket would be the word that I use, you know, going from roughly 2010, 2011, New York had, according to tax records, about 28,000 millionaires, or if you want to say multimillionaires, it doesn't really matter. It's a lot of money. To 2018, now there's enough millionaires to fill Yankee Stadium. There's about 53,000. That means to me that those at the top are doing very well. All we're talking about is an adjustment in the tax rates at the top for those making $5 million or more, $10 million or more, and then, yes, a wealth tax on those most able to pay. This is not about taxing the middle class. This is not about taxing the working class. We've paid, and our students are paying through higher and higher tuition. It's time for those who have made a real killing over the last 10 years to pay a bigger share of the public burden. You know, FDR always said that we pay taxes. It's the price we pay to live in a civilized society. Those at the top are benefiting from this civilization. They need to pay their fair share.
You're estimating about, I see, $2 billion in generating revenue for the state, new revenue, that is, for the millionaire's tax. But you also have something called a pied-à-terre tax.
Yeah, and that's something that we hope gets more traction this year because it impacts those folks who don't even live full-time in New York State, but they own very high-priced real estate in New York City. And it's only targeting those living in New York City, and it is just those who are partial residents. It is to tax their residents for, again, generating revenue for the sake of the greater good. I think it makes absolute sense. It's not going to impact those of us, you know, in the more economically challenged areas of upstate New York or even those living in the suburbs. It's New York City, partial residents, those who can afford to pay once again.
Am I sensing some irony in this next question I'm about to ask? The idea that SUNY is always seen as a place you can level the playing field, where when you have a society of have and have nots, some that have not can have by going to school at a SUNY campus. But then there's something within the SUNY mechanism, the budget process, the called capital construction.
Yes.
And you're suggesting that the way this is going to be meted out will mean that certain campuses, the ones with more money, will have more in terms of construction than the ones that don't.
Yeah, I understand that the chancellor and the governor want to bring in private money so that we have private partner, public-private partnerships. I understand that, I would say, theoretically, and perhaps to a very limited extent.
Well, let me interrupt just for one second, because you brought up public-private partnerships. We've seen this play before.
Yes, we have.
And to the tune of SUNY Poly.
Yes.
And the Buffalo Billions and Syracuse.
Startup New York.
Startup New York.
A lot of these ideas.
And I would say that some of the reviews after that have not been good, including some of the people that have gotten charged and some gone to jail for it.
Yeah, and I think part of the problem is what is lost is the principle of a public institution to serve the public good. If it is a public good, and certainly education is a public good, then the public must have ownership of those institutions, invest in them through a fair tax system, and then benefit from them. I think in proposing that campuses would have to raise roughly a third of the money for any construction project or capital project would seriously harm those campuses with the least ability to raise that money, whether it's for, you know, through continuous cuts in areas to generate money or to try to get private investors to front money. The big university centers aren't going to have a problem, but they're already doing very well. It's the smaller campuses, the comprehensive campuses at places like Fredonia, Buffalo State, and at tech campuses like Morrisville or my home campus at Cobleskill. They're the ones that are going to suffer in coming up with the money so that then they can get the public money. I don't like the idea that public money is being held hostage to a process that has to generate. You have to generate private money in order to get it. You've got the system backwards. The public money should flow. That's the idea of a public university system. Campuses can be encouraged to raise private money, but let's make sure the public money is there first and foremost.
Quite a difference between campuses, too, across the state. I mean, you have research institutions, colleges that cater more to students or more to a skill set. So, you know, you can't lump SUNY all into one plate.
No, you can't. And then when you take a look at the campus foundations that some of the university centers have, especially Stony Brook and foremost is University of Buffalo, which has the largest campus foundation, over $1 billion that they can raise. You know, that puts them in a huge advantage over the smaller campuses. And again, we get back to an issue of justice and fairness that this university system was first created to address, to make New York State much more of a middle class state and not a state that has a wide disparity between the rich and the poor.
Well, what about the so-called TAP gap? For those that don't understand what that word means, explain.
And this is where, you know, the continuous increase in tuition is really creating what I would see as a two-pronged problem for campuses and for students. I would say for all of SUNY, because first of all, a tuition assistance program is the most generous, extensive financial aid program in the United States. It's a great program. Over a third of SUNY students benefit from the TAP program. So this is a great success. The problem is, starting around 2011, there was a cap placed on how much money a campus would get per TAP student. As tuition rose, that created a gap. Campuses have to forego tuition, or more accurately, state funding for TAP recipients. If I'm a full TAP awardee, I get the full coverage of the tuition cost. Okay, that's taken care of by the state. It's literally off the books. Right now, it's around $7,020, $7,030, somewhere around there. Meanwhile, the campus will only get $5,000 in state revenue. That's the gap. Roughly, let's simplify things, $2,500 per full TAP awardee. Now, the proposal has been made to raise tuition for five more years, $200 per year. That would exacerbate this TAP gap for the campuses least able to afford taking in these students. Here's the real problem, Dave. The campuses that take a disproportionate share of TAP students are the campuses that are suffering the most.
Well, Fred, thanks so much. When we come back next week, we'll have a lot more to talk about because we haven't even scratched the surface when it comes to the issues affecting UUP and higher education.
Thanks very much.
That about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 2009. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time. For more news on New York State government and politics, for the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Giustino.